The title of today's sermon is Great Faith, and I'd like to begin in Matthew chapter 8. Brethren, do we possess great faith, or are we just fooling ourselves? Do we know the difference between a great faith, which we all want to have, and a false faith, a pseudo-faith, which is not a faith at all? Let's understand, it is possible to believe in Jesus Christ and all that he did and still have no faith at all. In today's sermon, I'm going to explain. Let's see what the scriptures tell us. Let me give you an example. Adam and Eve walked in the Garden of Eden with Jesus Christ. They talked with Jesus Christ. They saw him. Face to face, they interacted with Jesus Christ, and yet they did not believe him. Adam and Eve had no faith in Jesus. Knowing about Jesus is not faith. Seeing Jesus Christ in person did not produce faith in Adam and Eve. Why didn't they possess great faith? They lived in the most beautiful garden, newly created by God. They had everything going for them, and yet they had no faith in Jesus Christ. They did not believe him. They didn't believe what he said. They did not follow the instructions of Christ. As a result, they did not choose life, and they died. Jesus had warned them that if they ate of the forbidden tree, they would die. Okay, Matthew chapter 8. Let's begin in verse 1. This is about Jesus Christ, and this is right after the time that Jesus gave the Beatitudes and taught the disciples a few things like the most important aspects of prayer. We come to Matthew 8, 1. And when he, Jesus, was come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. Verse 5. Okay, Jesus travels over to Capernaum. That's a town up there on the Sea of Galilee. And when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came unto him a centurion beseeching him. This is a man, an officer of the Roman army. They usually commanded anywhere from 83 to, we use the word centurion to describe 100 men. But he's begging of Jesus Christ. And we're going to see something very important here. This is where we get the title of today's sermon. Jesus is going to declare that this centurion has great faith. And it's interesting. He's a Roman. He's a Gentile. He's not a disciple, per se, of Jesus Christ. And here's what he said, verse 6, and saying, Lord, my servant lies at home sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. So he's in a terrible way. Pain, lack of control. And Jesus said unto him, I will come and heal him. Jesus was going to go to him, lay hands on him, and heal him. That was the way that Jesus did it. Verse 8, notice this. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. Healed. There's a lot in that verse, brethren, that we can learn from. He's not pompous. He is not arrogant. He has a humble attitude. He says, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof. He's a great man. Jesus Christ is a nobody. But the centurion understood the difference that so many in the land of Palestine missed in those days. I'm not worthy for you to come to my house. You just say the word only. Just speak it, Lord. My servant will be healed. Now, I have a question. Did the centurion somehow understand that all that Jesus had to do was speak? He knew somehow that Jesus had that much authority and power. How did the centurion come to understand that? Notice verse 9. The centurion says to Jesus, for I am a man under authority. See, he knew what it meant. He was under and obedient to a higher authority over him. you know, he answered to the general or you know, to Caesar, whatever. But, you know, he understood how authority works. And he is saying that he knows that Jesus also understands this. I'm a man under authority, having soldiers under me. I say to this man, go. He goes. And to another, come. And he comes. And to my servant, do this. And he does it. Did the centurion somehow understand that Jesus was also under and obedient to a higher authority over him, God the Father? Now, Jesus spoke of great faith with regard to this Roman centurion. Verse 10. When Jesus heard it, he marveled. Now, I would suspect it takes a lot for Jesus Christ to marvel. He marveled and he said to them that followed. He's not saying this to the centurion. He's saying to this to all the people that are observing what's going on, because this is being done in the public sector. He said to all of those people publicly, truly I say unto you, I have not found so great faith. No, not in Israel. Now that's a pretty big statement. What was it about this encounter that caused Jesus to marvel that the centurion's faith exceeded all that of the Israelites? Why did Jesus describe the centurion's faith as great faith? The centurion believed what Jesus said. He believed that Jesus had the authority. He believed that Jesus had the power to accomplish it, to perform it. Verse 11, Matthew 8 and verse 11. And I say unto you, this is Jesus speaking to the crowd, that many shall come from the east and from the west and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. And that, it sounds like Jesus has jumped track. He's changed the subject, but Jesus is still right on cue. Verse 12, but the children of the kingdom shall be cast out in the outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus Christ is making a distinction here. He's making a distinction between true faith, real faith, great faith, and on one hand, this great faith, and on the other hand, a false faith or a pseudo faith, which is no faith at all. 13. And Jesus said unto the centurion, so he turns back to the centurion, and he says, go your way, and as you have believed. Now, Jesus is ascribing to this centurion belief. Jesus knows that he is a man of faith. He believes. As you have believed, so be it done unto you. See, that was an exhibition of great faith on the part of the centurion. And as a result, as a reward, as a gift from God, Jesus says, and his servant was healed in the selfsame hour. So Jesus didn't have to go and lay hands on the servant. Jesus just spoke the word because Jesus was rewarding that great faith. The centurion was rewarded greatly. His chief servant with palsy, that was some kind of paralysis from a stroke or disease, he was completely, totally, and utterly healed. And brethren, I guarantee you that upon hearing of the healing, the centurion gave God the full credit. You know, he didn't say to himself, you know, my servant would have probably gotten well anyway. People say that today, even after being anointed sometimes. Well, I did it because I'm supposed to, but I probably would have got healed anyway. Brethren, give God the credit. That goes along with the great faith. I'd like you to keep your marker here in Matthew 8, because we're going to come back here and around here quite a few more times today. But I'd like to go over to John chapter 10. How did Jesus perform these miracles? How did it work? We'll get an example over here in John 10. I'd like to begin in verse 19. It says, there was a division, therefore, again, among the Jews for these things. They were kind of debating and squabbling about who Jesus was, what he did, how he got his power, were the miracles real, and so forth. Let's read on. But what we're going to see here, brethren, are some examples of human reasoning. And this is not faith. Let me just point out that what we see here is not of faith. John 10 and verse 20. And many of them said, they're speaking about Jesus Christ. He has a devil. You know, he has a demon. He's a madman. He's crazy. Why are you hearing him? Why are you listening to this man? And in other words, they knew that Jesus was doing some outstanding, remarkable things, but they thought it was being done through sorcery or trickery, or the people in the crowd were plants. They weren't really sick or blind at all, and that, you know, this was some game that Jesus was, a con game that Jesus was working on. Verse 21, others said, these are not the words of him that has a devil. Can a devil open the eyes of the blind? You know, someone being healed of blindness from birth, for example, that was hard to refute. But they tried to explain it away. Nonetheless, they were really trying to dismiss the miracles that Jesus Christ was working. Verse 22. And it was at Jerusalem at the time of the Feast of Dedication, and it was wintertime. Now, that's not one of the Feasts of the Lord. That's one of the man-made feasts, kind of like our Thanksgiving day. It's not a day of holy convocation, but it was a day that was marked. Verse 23, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. That was an addendum, an extension on the temple. Verse 24, then came the Jews round about him, and they said unto him, how long do you make us to doubt? And in other words, how long are you going to keep us in the dark? When are you going to really speak out openly and tell us what's going on? If you be the Christ, continue in verse 24, tell us plainly. Just spell it right out. Verse 25, Jesus answered them, I told you, and you believed not. Notice that. Jesus had told them, they believed not. Then Jesus says, the works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. Jesus Christ says, miracles are being performed. You know, the lame walk, you know, the deaf hear, the blind see, all manner of healings. Those bore witness of Jesus Christ. Verse 26, but Jesus Christ says, you believe not. Now, brethren, I'm going to emphasize over and over in today's message this concept of believing or not believing, of faith or not faith, a great faith on one hand, a pseudo faith, a false faith on the other hand, because Jesus Christ is making these distinctions. He says in verse 26, you know, even in spite and with all of these miracles, you believe not. Why? Because you are not of my sheep. As I said unto you, my sheep hear my voice. I know them. They follow me. And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish. Neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. And Jesus Christ is speaking about people with true faith, not those who have no faith at all. Jesus continues, verse 29, my Father, which gave them to me. He's talking about the disciples, those who would be the Christians. My Father is greater than all, and no man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. Brethren, that's a tremendous point of confidence that we can have. If we're faithful, if we are people of faith, no one can pluck us out of the Father's hands. We are bought by Jesus. We belong to him. Then Jesus clarifies in verse 30, I and my Father are one. Now that stepped on some toes because Jesus was making himself equal to God, and they weren't missing the point. Verse 31, the Jews took up stones again to stone him. So this is an ongoing controversy. You know, not only were tensions escalating, but because of the words of Jesus, they concluded that they had the legal right then and there to take his life, right there on the spot. But Jesus continues on teaching, verse 32. Jesus answered them, "Many good works have I showed you from my Father." Jesus is right to give God the Father the glory, the credit for the healings, for the miracles. We'll see after a while that Jesus didn't claim to have the power on his own. He gave his Father the credit. Jesus was a man in the flesh. God the Father was the one that was actually working the miracles. "Many good works have I showed you from my Father." But let me ask you a question. Jesus is saying this. "For which of those works are you stoning me?" Let's get this straight. Was it when I healed the blind man? Is that the one you're going to kill me for? With the lame walking? Which of these miracles are you stoning me for? Verse 33. "The Jews answered him, saying, 'For a good work we stone you not, but for blasphemy, because that you, being a man, make yourself God.'" So that they said, "You went way too far. We're going to kill you for that claim." Verse 34, Jesus answered them, "Is it not written in your law?" Of course, it was Christ's law. In fact, it was the words of Jesus Christ. "I said, 'You are gods.'" So Jesus goes back here to Psalms, and he quotes a psalm that they know, but they didn't know how to apply it. Verse 35, "If he called them gods," if God the Father called them gods, "unto whom the word of God came, and the scripture can't be broken," he tells them, you know it's true. "Say you of him who the Father has sanctified, who the Father has set aside and sent into the world, 'You blaspheme because I said, I'm the Son of God.'" Verse 37, "If I do not the works of my Father, then," Jesus said, "if I'm not doing the works of my Father, then believe me not." Don't believe in me if I'm not doing the works of the Father. "But on the other hand, if I do the works of my Father, though you believe not in me, believe the works." Now understand something, brethren. Jesus Christ is saying that there are different degrees of faith. There are different kinds of faith. If you can't believe on a spiritual level, at least believe on a physical level that there is something incredible happening here. Again, verse 38. "But if I do," and it's understood here, "the works of my Father, though you don't believe in me," you believe me not, "believe the works, that you may know and believe that the Father is in me and I in him." Jesus is saying, at least believe in the miracles. At least believe that the miracles are really works of God, that they are indeed true miracles. Because some of them were trying to say they're not even real miracles, they're just sleight of hands, tricks. Verse 39, "Therefore, they sought again to take him." So they decided, they're going to kill him. And that's when Jesus Christ, slipped out of their hand. He escaped. John 14, let's begin in verse 10. "Believe you not that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I speak unto you, I speak not of myself, but the Father that dwells in me, he does the works." So Jesus is telling them that God the Father is the one who works the miracles. Verse 11, "Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe me for the very works' sake, for the miracles' sake." Just at least believe the miracles, that there's a witness going on in this nation right now, that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, and these miracles would be evidence that he is the Messiah. Jesus is saying that they should at least admit and believe for the very works' sake that miracles were being performed in the physical realm, in on an earthly plane, that there was something very incredible going on. John chapter 3. "Now, brethren, there is no biblical evidence of which I am aware that the centurion of great faith that we began with, that he was called by God." There's no biblical evidence that he came to conversion, that he was one of the saints. He simply, truly believes. he had great faith in the miracles. He had faith in the miracles that Jesus performed. The centurion believed in the earthly works that Jesus did. Earthly works is what Jesus called his miracles. They were done on earth, two physical people, you know, flesh and blood people. Jesus distinguished between the spiritual, the heavenly concepts of the gospel message, and the earthly miracles of healing that pointed to Jesus Christ as the Messiah. But the miracles were not the gospel. That was something separate from the gospel. That would show who the Messiah was. Isaiah spells that out very clearly. But note this. The centurion was not afraid to approach Jesus publicly in broad daylight. He came out and he professed himself to be a believer. I know that you have the authority. I'm one that's under authority, he said. And brethren, that's not always the case. Contrast that action, that outspoken, that daylight proclamation of the centurion, you know, to approach Jesus Christ. Contrast that with Nicodemus, who on the other hand was fearful. He came to Jesus Christ by night. You know, Nicodemus did not want it getting around that he was speaking with Jesus, that he was talking to Jesus. Even though Nicodemus' buddies, the Pharisees, they knew that God was involved in Jesus' miracles. How do we know that? Let's read here in John chapter 3. I'd like to begin in verse 1. And we'll see that by Nicodemus' own words, not only did he know, but there were others that knew that God was involved in Jesus' miracles. John 3 and verse 1. There was a man of the Pharisees, his name was Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. So he's a high, powerful man. Verse 2. The same came to Jesus by night, you know, in the dark of the night, and he said unto him, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God. We know that you are a teacher come from God. You know, he and the other Pharisees that came, the others didn't come, but they knew. For no man can do these miracles that you're doing except God be with him. They reasoned that. They understood that. They knew that Jesus Christ was not a charlatan or a trickster. Verse 10. And Jesus answered and said unto him, art thou a master of Israel, you know, one of the teachers, one of the professors, and you know not these things? Nicodemus didn't understand the concepts that Jesus Christ was telling him. And Jesus Christ was telling him some very basic things. Now, notice Jesus Christ is going to make a contrast between, you know, heavenly works and wonderful spiritual things and plain old basic knowledge of the physical and the earthly that he was dealing with. Verse 11, truly, truly, I say unto you, we speak that we do know. We speak that we do know. We know what we're talking about. And testify that which we have seen. And you receive not our witness. Jesus Christ is saying, I'm telling you how it is, but you're not receiving my words. You're not hearing me. You're not believing, Nicodemus. And he says in verse 12, here's a clarification. Jesus says to Nicodemus, if I have told you earthly things, if I have told you very basic things, things that pertain to the physical, the flesh and the blood, if I have told you earthly things and you believe not, and Jesus is right on target here. Nicodemus didn't believe. There would be a different result if he really believed, and the others that Nicodemus alluded to, if they really believed, they wouldn't be sneaking there by night. They'd be more like the centurion. They'd be out there in the open, bold daylight. If I have told you earthly things and you believed not, how shall you believe if I tell you of heavenly things? So see, Nicodemus is not at this point getting off first base because he does not have a great faith. He doesn't have a true faith. His faith is lacking. Let's go over to John chapter 12. Now, we know the story, brethren. Nicodemus finally came around, and he became bold in the faith. And he even defended Jesus Christ at the time of the trial, at the crucifixion. And he was also there with Joseph of Arimathea when they laid claim to the body of Jesus Christ and put the spices and so forth to prepare Christ's body for burial. Nicodemus was a part of that. It says in John 12, let's pick it up here in verse 42. Nevertheless, among the chief rulers also, many believed on him. Now, brethren, the scripture says that among these rulers, they believed on him. But ask yourself, if their belief was a true faith, or if it was somewhat lacking. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. So what kind of faith is being spoken of here in verse 42? Many believed on Jesus. Brethren, I bring this out because I believe that in today's Church of God, the scattered Church of God, the broad in general, the greater Church of God today, I believe that there are brethren who have a faith. But here's an important question that we need to ask. You know, do we believe on Jesus like these men here believe on Jesus Christ in verse 42, John 12 and verse 42? Ask yourself if their belief was a great faith, if it was a true faith. Because notice the evidence that is given. But because of the Pharisees, they didn't confess Jesus, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. You see, along with great faith, there comes some requirements to stand boldly for the truth, to not be ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. When you stand up boldly for what Jesus Christ teaches and believes, you will be put out of the church. You will be put out of the synagogues. They knew it then, and it's the same today. John 12 and verse 43. For they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. They had their good old boys club, and boy, they liked to pat each other on the back and get all dressed up for church on Sabbath and go down there and sit in the highfalutin seats. They loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. And that statement shows us clearly that they did not have the praise of God because of their fear. They were fearful of being put out of the synagogue. How many brethren also failed to confess Jesus when it's time to take a stand, brethren? Okay, now turn back to Matthew 8. You should have your marker back there. We're going to look at some of the things that cause faith to go off track, to be weak, to fail, to be false, to be a pseudo-faith. The first point that I have is fear. Fear wars against faith. We just saw that these Pharisees didn't confess Jesus because they feared they would get kicked out of the synagogue. Fear wars against faith. Matthew 8 and verse 23. And when Jesus was entered into a ship, his disciples followed him. So they're up there on the Sea of Galilee, and they get into a rather large boat. Verse 24, and behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea. Now, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves. But Jesus was asleep. So there's Jesus. It's a storm. The boat's rocking around. The waves are breaking over this boat. Apparently, this boat had some kind of a topside on it. There was that much of a ship. Jesus was asleep in there in this horrible storm. Verse 25, and the disciples came to him and they woke him up saying, Lord, save us. We are perishing. We're not going to get out of this. I mean, it was enough that the boat was about to either flounder, capsize, sink, or something. They thought they were goners. Verse 26, and he said unto them, and notice this, brethren, this is an important point. Why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Now, that says a whole lot. Okay, what it says is that if they had any faith at all, they would have understood Jesus wasn't going to drown right then and there, and the work of God be all over with, and you know, they're all dead, and he's dead, and that's the end of the story. That's not the end of the story. That's not the way that it ends. They didn't have faith enough to realize that there was going to be a tomorrow, that Jesus was going to finish his ministry, that he was going to pay the debt of our for our sins with his blood and all the other things. They had little faith, very little faith. Why are you fearful, O you of little faith? He arose, he rebuked the winds of the sea, and there was a great calm. That's one of those times when the water is so slick you can see your reflection in it. Brethren, we see another case where Jesus marveled. A while ago we saw that Jesus marveled, and that's something spectacular, that Jesus would go, wow. But in this case, it's going to be just the opposite, not for great faith, but this is the opposite end of the spectrum that we would see here. And I imagine it takes quite a lot to make Jesus Christ say, wow, I marvel at that. Mark chapter 6, brethren, if you can. It says in verse 5, he could do there no mighty work, save that he laid hands upon a few sick folks. He healed them. He had compassion on some that were sick and healed them in spite of themselves. But, brethren, what does it take to astonish Jesus Christ? Verse 6, he marveled because of their unbelief. You know, they just wouldn't give God the Father any credit. They wouldn't give Jesus Christ any credit at all. It was just like, how can they live in such denial? And he went about the villages teaching. So in spite of their hearing of and their seeing the miracles, they lacked any faith in Jesus because, you know, he was just a local resident and they just weren't going to believe. Matthew chapter 14. Back to that Roman centurion that we were talking about. That Roman centurion, he approached Jesus Christ without, you know, we mentioned that he approached Jesus without any fear. He wasn't afraid. He approached Jesus without hesitation. He went to Christ without any reservations. He had no doubt that Jesus Christ would comply with his request when he beseeched Jesus, that Jesus would grant him his wishes. Okay, we come to point number two. Doubt. Doubt is an enemy of faith. And we're going to see that in the scriptures. Matthew 14 and verse 22. Straightway, Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship, to go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. So this is a time that they're getting in a boat. Verse 23, and when he had sent away the multitudes, he went up into a mountain to pray. And when evening was come, he was there alone. So he sends the disciples off in the boat. He sends the multitudes away, and Jesus goes up in the mountain to pray. This is not the same incident when Jesus Christ was in that ship that we saw a while ago. Verse 24. But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. So this is a different occasion. And at the fourth watch of the night, you know, this is really late, and there's a big storm going on, Jesus went unto them, or we'd say came unto them, walking on the sea. What an incredible thing. Jesus is walking on the sea, coming to them. Verse 26, and when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled. They were fearful again, but they were really bothered, saying, it's a ghost. It's a phantom. It's a spirit. And they cried out for fear. They were rather superstitious fellows at this point. But they knew that men didn't walk on water, and they didn't have a lot of faith at this time. Verse 27, but straightway Jesus spoke unto them, saying, you know, greeting, be of good cheer, it's me, it is I. Don't be afraid. You know, so they were afraid too. Verse 28, and Peter answered him, and he said, Lord, if it's really you, if it be thou, bid me come unto you on the water. That's a strange request that Peter would say, if it's you and you can walk on water, I can walk on water too. And I don't know with what sincerity Peter said this. He's, you know, Jesus has just pointed out again that they have the fear, but he's going to make a point out of Peter. And I'm sure God put this in Peter's mind because there's another lesson to be taught here. Peter says, you know, if you walk on water, I can walk on water too. I don't know how, but you know, make it happen. Verse 29. And so Jesus said, come on. And when Peter was come down out of the ship, you know, he went over the side, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. So he was doing the same as Jesus. He was walking. And I'm sure that all the other disciples were pretty flabbergasted at this time. They see Jesus walking on water and Peter walking on water, and they knew Peter couldn't walk on water. Verse 30. And then, you know, while Peter is walking towards Jesus, he gets his eye off of Jesus. He lets his attention wane. And when he saw that the wind was boisterous, you know, a gust of wind hit him, he was afraid again. And beginning to sink, he cried, saying, Lord, save me, because the waves were, you know, I'm sure Peter could swim real well. There's other examples of Peter swimming. But here the waves and the chop are too much. You know, he was sure that he was going to drown. Verse 31. And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hands, and he caught him, and he said unto him, O you of little faith, again. But this time he's not going to pinpoint the fear and the being afraid that we've seen so much of, even in this example. He says, why did you doubt? See, what happened is Peter, as long as he had his eye on Christ, as long as he wasn't thinking about it too deeply, was saying, you know, if Jesus can walk on water, I can walk on water. But he got out there and the wind hit him, and he didn't have the security of the boat, and he doubted. He doubted. Matthew chapter 6. Let's use the centurion as an example, continuing. The centurion was not worried that he would be rejected by Jesus Christ. You know, the centurion could have said, you know, it won't do any good to talk to him. I'm not worthy. He's not going to heal my son. He could have worried himself sick. He could have not even struck out to see Jesus Christ in the first place, never approached Christ. He could have just worried himself sick and said, you know, or just forget the whole thing. Point number three, anxious worry or being overly concerned destroys faith. And we might say, well, I can't help but worry. You know, the one I love is sick, or the one that I really need is in peril. Worry and concern destroy faith. They war against faith. They're the opposite of faith. Let's look at Matthew chapter 6. Verse 33. But seek you first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. There's a formula for Christian living right there, brethren. All these things shall be added unto you if you seek first the kingdom of God. But notice this caveat, this warning that Jesus Christ gives in verse 34. Take therefore no thought. Now, if you look that up, that no thought, you'll find out that what it's talking about is talking about don't be worried. It's talking about don't be over anxious or anxious worry or being overly concerned. Don't be over worried for tomorrow. For the morrow shall take thought for the things thereof. Sufficient unto day is the evil thereof. That's just keep your eye on what's going on today. So the point that's being made here in verse 34 is that worrying about life and the things of life can destroy faith, be an enemy of faith. Let's go to Matthew chapter 16, and we're going to come to point number four, which is human reasoning. It can also be an enemy of faith. You can talk yourself out of the truth, and we'll see some examples of that. Matthew verse 6, and Jesus said unto them, take heed and beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So right out of the blue, Jesus starts teaching them a lesson when they realize we don't have anything to eat. Take heed of the leaven of the Pharisees. That's the food, the bread, the leavened bread of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now, human reasoning, let's go back to the centurion for a second. The centurion, if he had had human reasoning, it would have dictated to him that Jesus he would have said, no man can do these things. Therefore, Jesus is some kind of a charlatan. He's working magic tricks through sorcery or something. He could have talked himself out of it. But the centurion did not allow any carnal rationale to interfere with his belief. He believed in Jesus' powerful intervention. He didn't use human reasoning. Human reasoning would have talked him out of going to Jesus. He had a higher reasoning than that. See, we can get into justification and logic and all these biases that we carry. Brethren, the kingdom of God is not reasonable to the carnal mind. That's not the way that it works. Matthew 16 and verse 7. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, is it because we've taken no bread? Is that why Jesus is saying, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees? Verse 8. Which when Jesus perceived that, he said unto them, O you of little faith, this is the way Jesus says it each time, why reason you among yourselves? You're talking yourself out of the good things of God when you start thinking like that. You're reasoning yourselves away from the truth. You're reasoning yourself away from faith. Why reason you among yourselves? Because you have brought no bread. So, brethren, rationalizing is finding a good reason for the things that we know are wrong or out of place. Or in this case, they were rationalizing away the good things that Jesus was doing and applying some lesser standard. Rather than give God the full credit, they explained away in their minds the lessons of Christ. That's what was happening here. Why reason you among yourselves? You're missing the point. Verse 9, do you not understand, neither remember the five loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? You say, I've worked these miracles before using bread. You don't remember the seven loaves or the 4,000? How many baskets you took up? So Jesus, using everyday simple physical representations, Jesus was beginning to teach his disciples to look for the spiritual meanings of his message. He used the mundane to point to the profound. Notice verse 11, Jesus says, how is it that you do not understand that I spake it not to you concerning bread? That's not bread. Yes, we mentioned bread, but that's not what the subject is. That you should beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So at that point, the disciples go, oh, I get it. I get it. There's a deeper meaning. There's a higher meaning. So the disciples understood Jesus taught that way. That was a method of teaching that Jesus Christ used. Verse 12. Then they understood that he bade them not beware of the bread, the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Their lifestyle missed the mark. Their teachings were off course. True faith conquers fear and doubt and worry and carnal rationalization. Faith is knowing to the core of our being that God will perform the things he has promised to do. Not only the physical things, but most importantly, the spiritual things. The fundamental purpose of faith is to keep our mind on God and his promises, and to endure and to perform what God asks of us. Brethren, without equivocation, every instruction from God in the Bible is for the betterment of all mankind, the betterment of society. God wants us to put our trust, our faith in his promises to the point that we know it's going to take place, like the centurion knew that Jesus Christ would perform. Faith is the knowledge, the understanding, and the belief that it is God who is working out our salvation. I'd like to go back to the book of Deuteronomy as we close today. We'll finish back there in Deuteronomy because it's in the Old Testament. And the Old Testament does speak of faith. I'd like to go to Deuteronomy 31. Brethren, let's understand, we do not bring about our own salvation. We have to have a great faith, a spiritual faith, a true faith, a deep faith, a knowing faith, a fully believing from the core of our being faith. I'd like to go back here to Deuteronomy 31. Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. Moses has done that by the time we get to Deuteronomy 31. These are Moses' last days on the earth, maybe the last day of his life as we come to Deuteronomy 31. Moses is not allowed to go into the promised land because he sinned for a lack of faith, as a matter of fact. He didn't believe that God would perform when God says, you know, talk to the rock. He in lack of faith, struck the rock. Even Moses lacked faith. So, brethren, let's understand. Let's not take for granted, oh, I have great faith. Let's examine ourselves. The purpose of this message today is to examine what kind of faith do we have. And our faith can be measured by our performance. You know, how much do we believe can clearly be seen by how we perform to what God says we should be doing. Let's pick it up here in Deuteronomy 31, and let's begin at the beginning. We won't have time to read all of Deuteronomy 31 and 32, so I'll just highlight this in closing today, brethren. And Moses went, and he spoke these words unto all Israel. All 12 tribes are out there in the wilderness, and they're right across Jordan, about ready to go into the promised land. This is at the end of the 40 years. Verse 2, and he said unto them, I'm 120 years old today. I can no more go out and come in. He's weak and everything. Also the Lord had said unto me, you shall not go over this Jordan. He was not allowed to cross the Jordan River because of his sin of unbelief. Verse 3, the Lord your God, he will go over before you, and he will destroy the nations from before you, and you shall possess them. And Joshua, he'll go over before you as the Lord has said. So God's going to fight your battles for you, Israel. You just see Moses shouting out, you know, to all the people of Israel. Verse 4, and let's drop down to verse 19. Now, therefore, write you this song and teach it to the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel. Now, things take a strange turn here. God tells Moses to write a song and teach it to them. Teach them the melody. Teach them the notes. Teach them the words so that they'll say it, so that it'll become a part of them. But the strange thing is this song declares that Israel will fall away from God in a lack of faith. Verse 20, for when I have shall have brought them into the land which I swear unto their fathers, which flows with milk and honey, and they shall have eaten and filled themselves and gotten fat, they'll turn to other gods and serve them and provoke me, and they'll break my covenant. And it shall come to pass when many evils and troubles befall them, that this song, this Moses is writing them a song, we're going to read that in verse 32, shall testify against them as a witness, for it shall not be forgotten out of the mouths of their children. For I know their imagination, which they go about even now, before I have brought them into the land which I swear. Verse 21 tells us that God says, I know what they're going to do. They're going to go in there and turn to other gods. They're going to fall. They're going to turn away from me. That's what God says. Verse 22, Moses, therefore, wrote this song the same day, and he taught it to the children of Israel. Verse 23, and he gave Joshua, the son of Nun, a charge. He said, be strong and of good courage, for you shall bring the children of Israel into the land I swear unto them, and I will be with you. Okay, now, do you believe that? Do you have faith that God will be with you or not? Verse 28, drop down a little bit. Gather unto me all the elders of your tribes, all your officers, that I may speak these words in their ears, and call heaven and earth to record against them. Okay, this is a very profound thing. Verse 29, for I know that after my death, here's what you're going to do. You're going to utterly corrupt yourselves and turn aside from the way which I've commanded you. And evil will befall you in the latter days. Whoa, did you catch that, brethren? We just jumped a great notch here. We have jumped from ancient Israel to modern Israel. Evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. So this not only applies to ancient Israel, it applies to Israel, the Israelitish nations today, brethren. Verse 30. And Moses spoke in the ears of all the congregation of Israel the words of this psalm until they were ended. That's verse 30. Okay, so let's go over to verse 32, and we're going to see the psalm. It was written. It was memorized. Moses gave it to him. He set it to music and rhyme and rhythm. And you know, brethren, music has this marvelous quality. Once you have a psalm and it rhymes and it's melodious, you, sometimes you just can't get it out of your head. You know, if somebody starts singing, you know, one of your old favorites, you know, "You Are My Sunshine," you know, the tune pops up, the words pop up. That's the way our brains are wired. That's the way that God has made us. You just can't get a song out of your head. That's how Moses knew it would pass from generation to generation. And that's what God intended, that these words be passed down, as Moses put it, you know, to their seed and to their seed from generation to generation. Let's read a little bit of the song, Deuteronomy 32 and verse 1. "Give ear, O you heavens, and I will speak. O hear, O earth, the words of my mouth." A big proclamation by God. Verse 2. "My doctrine shall drop as the rain. My speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb, and as the showers upon the grass. Because I will publish the name of the Lord. Ascribe you greatness unto our God." So it starts off a very poetic and beautiful and pure. "He is the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are judgment. A God of truth without iniquity. Just and right is he." And so it's praising God. It is a very beautiful psalm. Verse 5. "They have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation." So it begins to talk about how Israel turns away from God and sins. And I'm sure it's losing something in the translation here. Let's drop down to verse 9. "For the Lord's portion is his people." Jacob is the lot, or the center reference margin says, the cord of his inheritance. We saw this in the opening hymn today, Psalm 135. His possession, his prized possession, Israel. It's talking about how God's work is centered around the people of Israel, the 12 tribes of Jacob. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. Verse 10, "He found him in the desert land, and in the waste, howling wilderness." Now, brethren, verse 10 is one of the most important verses in today's sermon. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 10. God found Jacob in a desert land, in a waste, howling wilderness. What chance did Jacob have? How would he ever be a great people? How would he ever be a prized possession? How would God ever work out his salvation in Jacob, become Israel? Notice what God did. He led him about. God led Jacob about. He instructed him. God is the one that instructed Jacob. He kept him as the apple of his eye. You know, nothing was going to happen to Jacob. Jacob was going to be preserved, protected, guided, instructed, and taught about God. Brethren, do we have the faith that God is leading, guiding, and instructing us as the apple of his eye, as his beloved children? Verse 11, "As an eagle stirs up her nest, flutters over her young, spreads abroad her wings, takes them, bears them on her wing." It's talking about protection and safety. Verse 12, "So the Lord alone did lead him." Jacob was led by God alone. It wasn't time. It wasn't chance. It was sure. It was positive. Proof positive. The Lord alone led him. There was no strange God with him. Verse 13. "He made him to ride on the high places of the earth." Look at the world today. The United States of America, the greatest nation that ever lived. England, the sun never set on the British Empire. Moses said it back here in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 13. He made him to ride on the high places of the earth that he might eat the increase of his fields. He made him to suck the honey out of the rock and the oil out of the flinty rock. How prophetic that is. Verse 14. Butter of kine, milk of sheep, fat of lambs and rams of the breed of Bashan and goats and the fat of the kidneys of the wheat. And you did drink the pure blood of the grape. We had the best of everything. We're in our up to our ears in abundant food and produce. Verse 15. But Jeshurun, that's Jacob. That's another name for Jacob, another name for Israel, waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxen fat, you're grown thick, you art covered with fatness. Then he forsook God which made him, and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. Verse 15, that is the faith of America. That is the faith of Great Britain. They lightly esteem the rock of their salvation. They've grown fat. They have forgotten the God of their youth. Verse 16, they provoked him into jealousy with strange gods. With abominations provoked they him to anger. They sacrificed to devils, not to God, to gods whom they knew not, to gods that came newly up, whom your fathers feared not. They didn't respect them. You know, false gods. That's the way of America. You know, the gods of Hollywood, the gods of Wall Street, the gods of armaments. Verse 18, of the rock that begot you, thou art unmindful. You forgot Jesus Christ and hast forgotten God that formed you, our Creator God. Verse 19, and when the Lord saw it, he abhorred them because of the provoking of his sons and of his daughters. Verse 20, and he said, I will hide my face from them. Brethren, do you understand what that portends to the English-speaking people of the world today? I will hide my face from them, Jesus Christ says. I will see what their end shall be. You know, what would Peter's end have been if Christ hadn't reached down and grabbed him by the arm as he sank into the foaming waves? I will see what their end shall be, for they are a froward generation, children, in whom is no faith. Brethren, don't let that go over your head. We'll stop right there. Verse 20. They are a froward generation, children in whom is no faith. He's talking about America today, Great Britain, all the English-speaking countries. They have no faith. But our question today, brethren, how deep does our faith run? Do we worship the true God? Are we led by the true God? Are we instructed by the true God? Do we believe the true God? Children in whom is no faith, verse 20. Brethren, this is the first place in the Bible the word faith is used. This is the first mention of faith in the Bible. God led Jacob. He instructed Jacob. He led Israel. He preserved him, not only in the wilderness, but across the seas and into the nations. And he blessed him and he made him great because of the promises he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But now they have no faith. The word faith only appears twice in the Old Testament, this place and one other. This is the psalm that they memorized. These were the last words of Moses. Brethren, do you and I believe? Do we believe, as it says in Romans 8 and verse 28, that all things are working together for the good for those that are being called? Do we have that faith? Do we have the faith to perform? Do we have the faith to believe? Do we have a great faith or do we have a weak faith? Brethren, have a great faith.